What's the secret to a happy life? For the answer, join us in Madrid from Thursday the 27th to Saturday the 29th of June for Monocle's 5th annual Quality of Life Conference. Head to conference.monocle.com for all the details and to buy your ticket. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Daphne Karnizis, standing in for this show's usual host, Josh Fennett. He's busy putting the finishing touches on Monocle's upcoming drinking and dining directory, which goes to press later this week. Coming up today...
If you look back through history, what you can see is how drawings are used not just to tell builders what to build, but also as a place where architects or planners or... even clients, one might say, kind of invent the world.
We delve into the strange powers of architectural drawings with Sam Jacob, former founding director of FAT Architecture. Also on the show, Italian architect and designer Piero Lissoni on his new showroom for the Padova and what's on his cultural agenda for this summer. Plus, a postcard from Toronto. We speak to architect Marianne McKenna about the city's knack for renewal and her practice's latest project, renewing an 124-year-old much-loved concert venue. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. Now, architecture is changing and manual skills such as model making and plain old pencil drawing have been eclipsed by CAD drawings and computers. But do we need to find a better balance? And what are the advantages of putting pencil to paper? Well, London-based architect Sam Jacob, former founding director of FAT Architecture, has been pondering what he calls the strange powers of architectural drawings. Jacob joined me recently here at Midori House to talk about why drawing by hand is still important and how a bad drawing can make things go catastrophically wrong.
It's really interesting to think about the role of drawings in architecture because some of it's very practical. It's really straightforward. It's the kind of stuff you give to a builder so the builder knows what to build and it tells them how big it is and so on and so forth. But equally, if you look back across the whole history of architecture, there's something that's different between building and architecture. And architecture is a thing which has a kind of very specific culture to it. It's about ideas. It's about the world that we create. It's about kind of visions. It's about ideas of society and how kind of economics and politics get manifested into the world that we inhabit. So, if you look back through history, what you can see is how drawings are used not just to tell builders what to build, but also as a place where architects or planners or even clients, one might say, kind of invent the world. So they're both a way of a very straightforward instrument in a sense, but also the place where kind of ideas about the world can be articulated, which I think makes them different from other kinds of drawings, let's say a kind of drawing from the world of fine art or a sketch which is trying to represent the world, because actually these are places where the world is invented.
And what do you think about the way in which drawing's taught? I mean, is it something that you think can be taught?
I think what's been really interesting over the last, 15 years is that the technology has changed so fundamentally. When I was studying, we still had drawing boards. We had a lesson in how to draw a measured perspective, which involves having huge planks of wood that you have to stretch out and marking out grids on the tracing paper and often making mistakes where you have to scratch it out with a razor blade. But of course now everything's digital. I think the question of what is a drawing now is really interesting. Is it something which has to be done by hand or...
What do you think?
Well, dexterity with a mouse is often more difficult than with a pen. So no, I think that the idea of drawing is definitely about kind of managing different bits of media in a two-dimensional plane. It doesn't necessarily have to end up on paper. It could just be, kind of moves from screen to screen. And in fact, a lot of, you could say, the sort of site for communicating architectural drawings now is, never hits paper. It goes from the person's screen who's making it straight to Instagram, straight to kind of somebody's folder of influences, and it gets kind of recycled that way. So, I think the idea of a drawing is something which is much more fluid, that isn't constrained by media or technique. I think that's a really productive way to think of what it might be, how you might make it and how you might use it.
Then if it's not done right, or if, you know, it's not translated in the right way when it comes to building it, obviously in your line of work as well, you're an architect, does it sometimes cause problems?
Yeah, I mean, there's famous cases of, most of them possibly urban myths, of like a drawing being read upside down by a builder and so the building gets built back to front, and the architect seeing the back to front edifice in front of him like throws himself in a canal or something like this. So yeah, there's always ambiguity in drawings, and that's problematic in an increasingly professionalized kind of bureaucratic way of building, where actually architects end up being on site much less than perhaps they used to be. And at the end of the day, in terms of like building, there's nothing beats being on site with a pencil in your hand, sketching out on a bit of plasterboard, resolving the detail with the guy who's about to build it. But a drawing is a really good way to sort of prepare for that, you know, like in terms of detailing or in terms of thinking about what's necessary in order to construct something. Also a place where you bring together so much information. Like if you think of the architectural drawing as kind of like having to consolidate the information from an engineer, services and pipes and wiring, like all of the kind of technical aspects, as well as does it feel nice and look nice. So you could say like a sort of thorough technical drawing, like a traditional architectural type, is almost like it's a multi-authored drawing. Like there's so many bits which come from so many different people. So it's actually, as a document, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
But definitely a kind of a code. And it's the code that you're using to communicate between all of these different people whose interests are different to somebody else.
Yeah. And we spoke a bit about books that collate drawings. Do you think that we have enough of those, or do you think that it's easy for someone to access drawings, in your opinion, if they're looking for architectural drawings for specific buildings, either ones that are still in progress or ones that have existed for decades?
Well, I mean, you find drawings in different places. There's the sort of, like, it depends on the type of drawing you might be looking for. You know, like, the drawings that you would produce for a planning application are, you know, a matter of public records. If you're interested enough, you can look them up on the planning portal. And
I found ones for the house that I'm renting, just to have a sneak. It was quite easy to find.
Yeah, exactly. There's archives of drawings. The RIBA and V&A have an incredible drawings collection of like 4 million and counting drawings. So if you kind of know what you're looking for, if you're researching something, you can go there. But I think what's fascinating culturally is a little bit like the way in which the act of making drawings has changed. Like our access to images now is so completely different to how it was, you know, even 10 years ago. Like the fact you can type something into Google Images and up comes a grid, and that grid would be different for you as it is for me because of, you know, whatever the algorithm is saying about our respective interests. And of course, there's so much stuff on the internet. Obviously not everything, but that ability to call up images, often out of context, you know, not like in a book where the caption and the narrative of the book stays fixed with the image. On Google Images, you lose all of that. It's not even a web page. It's just the image and a link. That's it. That's also one of the things that's changed in the way people are making drawings now. Like making digital drawings is almost like a kind of modern day version of collage, like bits of sky from somewhere, bits of wall from somewhere else, like doors from somewhere, like that get pieced together, merged with the 3D models that you might be making yourself across all kinds of applications. So you might be partly in Photoshop, partly in Rhino, partly in AutoCAD or whatever the application you're using. So they're very kind of mixed media.
And just finally, are there any examples of drawings that you find particularly inspirational or particularly well done in their technique? Or,
well, one of my favourite architectural drawings ever is a drawing by Joseph Gandhi for John Soane. And it's a drawing that they made when they were presenting the designs to the Bank of England of the new Bank of England. Mm. And it's just so amazing that they decided to show their proposed project as if it was in the future and had fallen into ruin. So you see a kind of, you see it kind of like sort of bird's eye view, but yeah, completely collapsed. There's something so clever about it. The first thing is actually, technically, what it does is show the spaces because there's no roof. So you can see in and you can see all of the organization of rooms. And it's a building with a lot of rooms in it. It's like a miniature city wrapped in a wall. But what it also did was kind of play to the client's kind of ambition. It's in ruins, but it's exactly that, that at that time, of course, kind of aristocrats would spend their youth on the grand tour going to see all of the kind of ruins of classical civilization. So in some way, Soane and Gandhi are saying, like, well, if you know, if you build
one
this,
day. Yeah,
you too will be remembered, like, yeah, these incredible mythical classical sites.
Yeah. That was architect Sam Jacob there speaking to me recently. Let's turn now to the opening of a new showroom here in London earlier this month, that of Italian furniture brand De Padova. One of the people behind the project is none other than architect and designer Piero Lissoni. Born in Italy in 1956, he studied architecture at Politecnico di Milano University, graduating in 1978. Beyond architecture, he's worked on designs in areas as diverse as furniture, kitchens, bathrooms, and lighting fixtures, and he's even developed corporate identities, signage, and packaging. Lissoni's clients include brands such as Alessi, Boffi, Capellini, Cassina, Floss, Cartel, and many more. Italian furniture brand De Padova's first London showroom was under his artistic direction and designed by architect Sir David Chipperfield. I went along to meet Lissoni.
We are now inside in this new apartment designed by Boffi and De Padova together. We are in Chelsea. We are in the first floor with the beautiful windows. We are inside in a quarter's life. And it's like apartment inside in a community life.
And can you just narrow in on that concept of the apartment? How do you mean that? In what sense?
I don't like to design shops. I like to design for De Padova flats. You know, when you move inside, you don't feel it's a shop. It's a flat. It's with, you know, well-divided, without wall ambiences. But you feel, you know, it's like an open space place. But it's a beautiful flat. A lot of windows and clear function inside.
And you're artistic director for various brands. How do you adapt to the different DNA of each brand, I guess?
You know, each brand is a creator with a different culture, and it's quite easy for me to adapt myself. Of course, I try to be anyway Piero Lissoni. I don't like to become a little bit too much elastic. But at the same time, you know, each factory is a factory with the proper DNA, the proper structure, the proper intelligences, and it's like intellectual approach. Each of them is different. One of them is different to the rest of the world.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about materials now. I know, for example, with brands like Salvatore, you worked with recycled materials. For example, with Miss Van der Rohe's Barcelona Pavilion, you used some of the leftover marbles. You also are part of the Guiltless Plastic Exhibition. Do you think that when it comes to furniture design, recycled materials and thinking more thoughtfully about materials is the future?
I don't know if it's the future for the recycling material, but for sure we try to be more passionate in that. But to be honest, you know, I don't like to recycle material for nothing because I prefer to design something with a long durability, because that one is a real secret to be recyclable, you know. You don't recycle material if you use a lot the same, you know. You buy one chair and you use the chair for many, many, many years. It's the best, you know. Not only for the aesthetics, but for, you know, you don't use too much energies for that. You need to offer a long life for the product. That's it.
Tell me about some of the other projects that you're working on right now, maybe something that you'd like to highlight.
You know, we work in many, many different projects. We just start after 1 month to design the new things for the next Salone del Mobile. You know, we didn't finish the party and we asked, you know, they asked us to start again with a new one. But we have a lot of projects all around the world in architecture. You know, some new buildings in the United States, some new in Amsterdam, Moscow, Germany, Beijing in China, Italy, you know. We are in process for many different projects. And all of them, they are anyway different with the special intelligences inside. And why not? A bit of stupidity.
What do you think of London and your presence in London and also, you know, just what you draw from the city when you come here?
Listen, London is for me a capital, but not a capital of Great Britain. It's a capital. It's a worldwide one of the most important capital in the world.
Has your perception changed at all based on the recent sort of political and, you know, the uncertainty?
I don't know, because I'm completely falling in love for London. I love London. I was in love years before and I'm in love again. I never understood the reason why something becomes so stupid, you know. But now, unfortunately, stupidity is worldwide. And unfortunately for you, you are not alone in the world. Anyway, the feeling is good for me, and I think now you need, you know, to do something different and to start to stop to think in the imperialistic point of view. You know, you need to be inside in a community, and the community is a European community. We are European in the end.
We're working on our summer edition of Monocle magazine. What your kind of summer hit is, be it a song or a film, it could be something new this year, or it could be something that you, you know, go back to again and again. Maybe it's an event or a favorite festival of yours back in Italy or anywhere in the world, really. Something cultural.
One of my special cultural boundaries is La Scala in Milano. No, I like the seasons in La Scala. I like this kind of melodramatic or the melodrama music, you know. I like the operas. And I like this special feeling when you are there, you know, with the sound, with the conductor, with the orchestra, you know, and voices. And again voices and again voices. And the beautiful temporary architecture inside. La Scala. The whole season, it's anyway a surprising season for me, because it doesn't matter if you follow, I don't know, Wagner, but, you know, it's again a new Wagner. This year, I'm so Falstaff from Giuseppe Verdi. I'm so Falstaff many years ago. And that Falstaff from 2019, it was for me unbelievable. You know, every time it's a new surprise.
And how many times would you say you go every year to La Scala?
Listen, I'm start to see something and to hear something in La Scala, to follow the different show in La Scala more than 40, 45 years ago. I was really young, really a young boy. And you become like addicted.
That was Piero Lissoni speaking to me recently at De Padova's new London showroom. Now, for the remainder of the show, we're handing over to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief, Thomas Lewis. He's joined by architect and master planner Marianne McKenna of KPMB Architects. She's completed projects for the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern, the University of Toronto, McGill University and Concordia, just to name a few. But McKenna's special focus is the design of concert halls and how design is used to engage the community. A case in point is one of KPMB's current projects, the renovation of the 124-year-old landmark concert venue Massey Hall in downtown Toronto. Here's McKenna talking about repurposing old structures with a contemporary approach, the case for renewal, and the importance of what she calls city rooms.
How difficult is it, sort of in principle, when you're approaching a building that is so established and distinct, I suppose, both in terms of the way it's used or has been used, also the way it looks and the totem it gives you when you go into that part of the city or, you know, where that building is? I suppose Toronto's been criticised, perhaps, of, I suppose, facadism, to coin a phrase, you know, where it seems as though perhaps city developers haven't really known what to do with a sort of a heritage building or how to incorporate it into a, you know, a new developing plot of the city. And perhaps sometimes the contrast between the old and the new seem quite jarring in certain instances. What's your take on that? How have you approached, you know, when you are tasked or when you win a commission to add something to a building that exists already? What are the things you're trying to avoid when you're sort of designing that new space?
I think what we're trying to avoid is a clash. You know, I think you want to, you know, in no way do you mimic the heritage building, but I think through the scale shifts, through materiality, through color palette, through detail, you know, bringing, you know, a level of detail into the new buildings, you can have a very clear juxtaposition of old and new that is refreshing, provides a contrast in some cases to the heritage, but actually gives, you know, meets program and is just entirely beautiful, you know. So I think you're not going to add, when we add to a church that we're looking at on Bloor Street, which is where we retain the heritage, it's very, very complicated because we're building over a subway and it's, you know, has, you know, complexities that one should never even have. You can see why it didn't happen. You know, now we have a very highly skilled team approaching this. But I think you're looking for, you know, really a familial idea. You have a very tall child and you have a very short and stocky child there. And how do they express themselves as belonging? You know, and how do you actually project that idea of the memory? You know, you're still trying to create memory in these new spaces. One of the tragedies, what you don't want to do is take these churches and make them into condos. You know, then it is the envelope may remain, but the meaning of the place is gone. So I'm quite delighted that in both of these instances, we retain the use and the memory, and we give communities a chance to come back in and find a way to reassemble. And I think beautiful spaces attract people. We see that with something like Kerner Hall at the Royal Conservatory, or the event space at the Globe and Mail, or the room at the Gardener, these wonderful city rooms that we've had the pleasure to build, attract and reform communities around them. And I'm hopeful, you know, whereas if you turn it into a condo, that's it. It's in the private domain. It's kind of gone.
Let's stick with the idea of the city rooms, therefore. Marianne, you, as you sort of touched upon there, you and your firm have created lots of these city rooms around Toronto, very different spaces to date. Just give us a brief outline of what a city room is, I suppose, and perhaps a little bit of the detail of what you are trying to create in each instance, say at the Gardener or at the Globe and Mail Centre.
So each of these rooms is an adjunct to the program. It's something that's added to, say, well, one of the more recent ones we did is in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, where there's a wonderful hall, and we completely rebuilt the lobbies. But beyond the lobbies, we said, let's create this city room, now called the Target Atrium, but let's create a room in which we can have a second performance space, but you can have a great dinner. It should have a terrace that extends itself out into the public realm and is part of PV Plaza, which has its own kind of context. And these rooms have become incredibly successful as in juxtaposition or in combination with the lobby and with the performance spaces. They are revenue generating. So I think, you know, one of the three legs of the sustainability stool is economic sustainability. Similarly, at the Globe and Mail, and it's published that they, with this new event space that sits on top of their office spaces, they offer it up as a space for outreach to a community. It's branded to the Globe and Mail, so instead of having events in other spaces around town, this is their own space. They can actually control, you know, how things are done. And that space generated $12 million last year, which was a kind of extraordinary. But people love the space so much, not only because of the space, but it has these spectacular 360-degree views, that it's in demand to the point of being used, turned over three times a day for a variety of different events. I think each institution has to sort of figure out, how would I do this? How would Minneapolis, Minnesota Orchestra Hall do it? How would the Rotman School of Business? And not every faculty can do this. But, you know, the architecture school, the new architecture school building, which we did not do, but they also have this kind of a room and they're reaching out to broader community, engaging a city in dialogue around architecture. So much got torn down. We're making the argument to look more deeply at our heritage buildings, even if they're from a brutalist era. Keep everything now and figure out how to repurpose it, even if, you know, or think how could we repurpose? How can we add to it? How, again, I've just won a competition for a very large office building that exists in Toronto, and they want to remake the whole public realm landscape at a very prominent corner and add a residential tower and add two floors to the office building. But it'll be transformative. It will rebrand this site in the city, a very prominent site in the city. This is exciting. You know, let's do it well, because you could make a mess of it too. So one has to, as an architect, you have to have confidence in the development community and the particular developer you're working with, that they actually can listen, respond. And I found of late, maybe it's because I'm maturing and I know what I think, a much better conversation between developer and architect that existed, you know, that I saw existing in our practice when we were, you know, putting up buildings perhaps a little too quickly into our context.
Thanks, Thomas. Thomas Lewis there in Toronto, speaking to Marianne McKenna of KPMB Architects. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, On Design Extra, available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, available on newsstands. Monocle on Design was produced by myself, Daphne Karnesis, and edited by Christy Evans. Next week, Josh Fenner is back in the presenter's chair. From me, bye for now.